The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill tries to get a separation. John horses around with $1 million per year of government money. Tom manages to actually hold a job. A wild pitch almost leads to a fire, but it gets quickly put out. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the 7 dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m. Join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Mark Baldino from Firebolt. Great to see you. How you doing?
Hi, Fred. Good, thank you.
I hear rumors that now you're selling, you know, your first $1 billion worth of Firebots in the first 3 months of operations, and that that I'm going to be wealthy beyond belief next week. Is that right?
Just short of $1 billion. We're not quite there yet, but we have about 2,000 sold, but we're doing well. We have a lot of possibilities out there, a lot of interest we're coming up with, so. Yeah.
So 2,000. The retail price is $300, right?
Correct. Retail price.
So that's $600,000 worth of sales if it was at retail, but it's not because you're selling to apartment complexes and these large rental properties, right?
Correct. And we're from a limited sales force of about 5 people. You know, we find that if we talk to the apartment management group, one person can decide, well, I'll take 4,000. Whereas if we go residential, you've got, you know, each individual deciding to take one. So it's a little bit more energy where we can get to the property management company very easily. And they need it more than anybody. They have a fire in an apartment building. It could burn down, you know, 20 units. So
it could kill a lot of people, and it's happened in the past, right?
It certainly does. It's actually happening probably every day. There's an apartment fire out there that causes major damage. And this is from the National Fire Prevention Association that keeps statistics and records of when the fire departments deploy, what call they go out on, and where they
go. That's only when they deploy, because a lot of them are put out at home by the homeowner, and maybe they get a little burn or something, but you know, that's it.
They say there's another over 1 million more stovetop fires that are self-extinguished. Varying degrees, some very easily, some you got property damage, you got burns, you got injuries to the occupants from the flames. So
my understanding is that people can buy them now, right?
They can. We're making them. In fact, we have a big order we're working on where we have to actually work Saturday and Sunday just to get them. Yeah.
So just to check, so if they go to thecybershow.co, we're going to have a link there so they can click on them and just buy direct. Is that right?
We do have a e-commerce page on our website where we still can sell them one at a time to residential. You know, if they have if they need to buy 5 or more or have a project like that, call me up. We have
what I'm thinking is, if we have a link on the Cyber Show, can I get a percentage of the sales?
I'm sorry. I got you. I guess it just hit me. Takes a little bit of time to go through my skull into my brain, but I.
All right.
Yes.
So you know, we have listeners all over the world. So if somebody from Afghanistan goes to buy one, I guess you're going to add shipping, right?
All they need to do is go to our website and add in the discount code A2E123. That'd be good.
You're on the air here. You're telling everybody to use A2E123.
We want to get some sales going.
All right, so my understanding is, you know, you're running out of capacity to make them. You're gonna be sold out, and not be able to make them if they don't order them soon. Is that right?
Well, we've got capacity to make 1,300 more right now, and we've got components coming in for 3,000 more. So we should be okay. We should be fine.
Well, I don't know. My radio show is going to probably produce 5,000 orders right away. So are you going to be able to fulfill them, what, you know, by Tuesday or what?
No. If we have to charter our own shipping container boat, we will. We'll go get them. You know, so we'll have them here.
All right, but you're not going to fly them in FedEx, right?
We did that with some pumps when we were first getting started. We won't do that again. There's a $4,000 fee. So actually, the shipping costs more than the pumps.
There you go. Now, just for clarity, so you make these things in the United States, right?
Yeah, we assemble them in the United States. Some of the components are U.S. made or produced here, like the circuit boards. We do have to get the pumps in China. I'm sorry, they're $425 and can't buy them anywhere else on earth cheaper. And they work good. You only have to work 2 minutes, but they put out enough PSI or pressure, and that's what we need.
When you get up to enough volume, of course, you'll start making them in your own plant, right?
We hope so, yeah. That'll still be a little bit of time away. We'll go with the...
the integrated circuits, you're buying the integrated circuits and just customizing them, right?
Yes, they're being made in Canada.
Isn't that part? That's part of America, right?
It is, yeah. They speak
the same part of language. North America, but it's not part of the United States of America, but okay. So fantastic, Firebots. And we've heard from you on the show before, and I don't want to belabor it with our poor audience here, but let's see, UL listed, the only UL listed stovetop fire solution that exists today, and it's good enough for industrial kitchen quality, right?
Well, yeah, it passes the same test as an industrial kitchen or a commercial kitchen. Yeah.
All right. I have so many questions. We don't have the time to answer them all, but let me just get a couple of them out. It's environmentally safe, right?
Yes. The suppressant we use is NovaCool. It's non-toxic, biodegradable. So you could take a bath in it and be okay. But
when the spray goes off, it not just puts out the fire, it also cools the surfaces to where the fire won't restart.
Which
means when it's done, you can just wipe it off with a cloth and you can start cooking again, right?
It's 1 liter of suppressant, so you are correct. You could use, you know, paper towels or washcloth and soak it up, wipe it down, and you're good to go.
No, you don't want to start another stovetop fire until you replace
the fire. For $70, you can get a refill kit, and that includes an extra new batteries. So you might as well, if you're removing the cover, replace the suppressant bag and the battery pack.
There you go. And if you're running an apartment complex or rental properties, or you're building homes, of course, you can get these things as well. And so again, you'll be able to go to thecybershow.co and click on the button and order direct, or, you know, get in touch with Mark for a higher volume sales and do it now. You'll get a discount off the retail price, I'll get a commission.
No, you won't get you will get a pat on the back, but no, you will not get a commission.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, at least our radio listeners will get a discount.
But we will give everybody $50 off if they enter the code A2E123. All right.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Enjoy.
Thanks, Fred.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying. Everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee-whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. The cyber war is heating up, and with it, the increased rate in the Boyd cycle of hyperbole. Operational technology malware components were leaked from a Russian IP address, demonstrating the ability to turn mechanisms on and off. Of course, this is what all such mechanisms do, so the hype cycle is breaking news on the Cyber Show.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m. Join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the all.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
All right. We're back with Bill, who's muted. Can you hear me now?
There we go. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. I can hear you now. So you use an iPad for these sorts of things, and I use a Chromebook. And the reason I use the Chromebook, I like the browser approach to things. I always use the browser, but in a Chromebook, because I don't trust anything about the browser. But the Chromebook, basically, you can take it back to Formula at any time by pushing a button. But I don't like the apps. And the reason I don't like the apps is because increasingly apps are doing things they shouldn't be doing. And in particular, things like WeChat. You know, I've seen these for a long time. Another one is I won't use Zoom anymore on any computer I care about, because Zoom has a long history of being bad about these things. You've chosen the apps because of their limited user function. But can you just talk about how you make these decisions and how you deal with the modern version of this world where you don't have control over anything?
I have a natural preference for apps. Going back to that talk that you gave at IBM Research in Hawthorne, I like purpose-built. The more generality, the more flexibility, the more complexity, the more the problems. And if you look at the tools we use today, no two browsers are alike. Everybody's got a different set of things that he has added into his browser. No two WordPresses are alike. And WordPress plugins are a major source of security vulnerabilities today. And so I like simplicity. I was complaining about the fact that on the NOTAM thing, we don't know whether or not the decision to ground all the planes was a planned decision or an ad hoc decision. And one of my colleagues from NPS, J.D. Fulp, responded. He says, "We are building a Tower of Babel. Our infrastructure is becoming so complex and so interrelated that it is almost not manageable." It's as though we took the controls for the autopilot and replicated the control between every two seats in the airplane. that we have so mixed up our management controls and our end user capabilities that we can no longer separate them. So that even if we did not have all the vulnerabilities that we have, we would still have a security problem. And the security problem is in the end users. You know, if you look at ransomware, reusable credentials for end users are implicated in about 70% of the successful ransomware attacks. So even if we didn't have the vulnerabilities in the software to be exploited, we still have to learn how to deal with all of these people and managing the privileges that they have.
So you've mentioned a couple of things. One of them is the separation of content from control, or, you know, signal is what they used to call it, right? So on the telephone system, you know, the signaling system was integrated with the telecommunications component, so you could, you know, make a sound with a whistle and tell the signaling system. Yeah. Yep. So that
was called signaling in band, and that's a very bad idea.
The internet is all in band signaling.
The other thing is that anybody who wants to can add a component to the internet. One of the interesting things in history was the success of IP over IBM's SDLC, which was much better controlled, but involved separated provisioning. We still have separated provisioning in the telco system, but not in the internet. In the telco system, if you want a telephone number, you've got to go to a telephone number provider and be assigned one. And you're going to have to pay for it, and you're going to have to identify yourself with it, but not in the internet. In the internet, anybody who wants to can attach a new device. Now, that was a good thing for a while. It allowed the internet to grow very rapidly. But in today's situation,
the fact that we can't fix accountability for a lot of what happens is the major issue, for particularly for privileged people. The way we control privileged people is we hold them accountable for what they do. But if you look at the situation of shared user IDs and passwords, who shares user IDs and passwords? Privileged users.
Right. That's because of a problem in the management plane, right?
And it causes us to lose the one control over privileged users that works, which is accountability, you know?
Yeah. So identity management is intended to address this, but of course we've aggregated the risk in the identity management infrastructure.
Right. And now we associate privilege with a particular user ID and password. We manage the privilege associated with it.
Typically, today it's going through roles and rules or attribute-based access control or some other such mechanism. So, but at the end of the day, identity associated one way or the other with authorization is the mechanism.
I fundamentally, go the other direction as you know, on this sort of thing, right? You know, and I'm trying to think of the analogies. I'm listening to what Bill's saying, but it's, a soldier in combat, right? An entity out in a biological environment like we all are, right? We live in these massive, and we have to function in these systems that are uncontrollable, right? And I think the evolution from, the telco system, they literally, I will run a pair of wires, with my, little hands, and I will plug them into something for you, to this open system we call the internet. It didn't just help it grow faster. I think it's fundamentally different. And as security people, I think it's, if nothing else, a lot of fun, but I think it's a more realistic challenge, right? No, you can't control it all. Maybe not any of it. Still, you're on the battlefield. What do you do?
Well, I think what Bill is asking is what to change it to. My view of it is that the lack of separation is problematic. And he is right that that's the cause, the underlying technical mechanism that is exploited by a lot of the attack mechanisms.
Yep.
And trying to figure out that that's what's going to happen by, observing the traffic or something like that is known to be undecidable. Whereas that separation mechanism is clearly available and we know how to do it. We seem like we're unwilling to do it. But then when you look at an iPad, and by the way, it's obviously not perfect in lots of ways, but when you look at that functionality, it's a lot safer to use because the user really can't screw things up other than their own data.
Right. But again, so I was thinking, since we just passed RSA, a couple of years ago, it was a panel, folks I all know and respect, discussing and debating whether or not we should have a separate national critical infrastructure internet. This separate physical, entirely separate, system to run really, really important things. And my answer is, you and I down in Columbia, a couple of years before that, having these same sort of conversations, like, okay, yes, maybe. If so, if that costs the GDP of the nation, then maybe you should, but you're not gonna. So you still live in this world. And now we're in the world with, in the operational technology world and critical infrastructure, everyone now this year, not last year, the year before, is talking about OT cloud because you kind of have to, right? So, from a security perspective, this causes us problems, I think also opportunities, but I think it removes this idea that we can control the environment we're going to operate in.
I think we're going to control the operating environment.
And I may be wrong. It's happening, not often.
If we don't, then we're going to, look, I don't think there has to be one world either, right?
Right.
I think if you look at critical infrastructures, right, if you look at power and water and these things, I think there's no reason, no excuse for them having all this, general purpose functionality. It's just unnecessary, and there's no value that it brings to those systems. And so, we've just sort of, spun the wrong direction for the desire. The other one is, the medical equipment regulatory changes say that if you're connected to the internet, it says you need to have something like an SBOM, and it says that you need to do change control on it. But what it doesn't say is what you should probably have is a digital diode so that nothing that happens on the internet has any change effect on anything inside the machine. and the machine just produces its output, and it goes through the diode, and then it goes to the network.
But I think the value is that we couldn't afford to have these systems otherwise, right? You know, you can start up a medical device company, for example, surprisingly easily, you know, without doing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of research. And if you had to, you know, carve your own chips or, you know, build them from scratch, that just wouldn't exist. So the entire.
But that's not what it takes. You didn't listen carefully.
Oh, I always listen carefully.
So what I said is you just put a digital diode in the middle. So you have exactly the same system you have right now. You put in a digital diode so that it can send output out to the internet, but it can't take input from the internet.
Yeah, that doesn't always fit. I know exactly what a digital diode is, but yeah. Anyways, you know, and it's not just medical devices. It's all these systems and the cost of bespoke manufacturing as opposed to, you know, using what's off the shelf and then trying to use it well. It changes the functionality entirely. You know, if I can't hear from the internet, that means as a device function differently.
Right. And when I put something in your body to keep your heart working properly,
I want a firmware update.
I think you don't want a firmware update. I think you want it to be designed so that it doesn't need one.
Yeah, yeah. I'll believe in that when I believe in unicorn ponies.
Okay. Then you don't mind if I update your heart?
Yes, please do.
Okay. So I will change who you love. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right.
Insecurity won't go. See me in shadow.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
John, when we were talking last time, we were talking about the stealth ship and the problems of making it, you know, unobservable or whatever the right word is, undetectable. But there was another challenge. There was an operation security challenge with building this thing, right?
Yep.
So you want to talk a little bit about how you managed to build a stealth ship without anybody knowing it?
Well, it was a huge challenge because the outer configuration of the Sea Shadow at that time was classified TSSCI.
Right, that's top secret.
Sensitive compartmented information.
Right. Yeah.
And it was a special access program. And so what we had to do, we had a week-long meeting with, by the way, the other interesting point about this, we started this program under an Air Force contract, building off of our...
the Air Force is building a ship, okay.
Yeah, well, that was the strange part.
Well, I thought that's part of the secrecy, right?
Well, it was part of the stealth community, and the only thing we were applying stealth technology to at that stage of the game happened to fly.
Well, submarines had been attempted to be stealthy for a long time as well, but that's a different...
Yeah, but that's an entirely different, there are similar issues, but it's an entirely different engineering model, if you will. And so we were well into the model of the Sea Shadow, and we were testing it back at various Air Force facilities. The contracting officer was an Air Force employee, and he wasn't read into the program.
So he didn't know what you were doing, but he was in charge of it. Okay.
And I can't tell you how many times he called me and said, "John, I just asked
you for a couple $100 million. I really can't tell you, but just send it here."
Now he said to me, he said, "Hey John, I just noticed you guys submitted an invoice for $3.5 million for horses and building a stable and hiring wranglers and stuff like that." And I said, "Yeah." And guess what? In 3 years, we'll have to replace them. And he says, "What in God's name?" He says, What are you gonna pull? And I said, "Well, we're not pulling anything. This is part of a of a plan that has been approved that I can't discuss any further. He said, "Oh no, no, no." He says, "Okay." He says, "I just had to ask."
Yeah, and, I knew you couldn't answer, but I had to ask. It's my job, you know.
Well, what it was, we had gotten far enough at that time with the demonstrator that we had to start testing it with threat radars. And so we took over about 100 acres of a naval weapons center located in a very remote site in California. And that became our new state. And we had to provide the security. We had helicopters. We had mounted, because this was desert. There were no freeways, no highways or anything like that. And oh, by the way, we also had an abundant supply of rattlesnakes. And what we had to do was build a table, essentially a table that was essentially 100, the radius of that table was 150 feet and circular. And
half a football field.
Yeah. So, and then we had to make the surface of the table look like water. We had to make to radar, it had to look like water.
Yeah.
Then we built this huge hydraulic system so that that table could be lifted and lowered, something on the order of, I think it was 35 degrees.
Yeah, to like a ship that's tilting on the ocean.
Well, that was so that the fixed radar, you could change the aspect that the radar was seeing without actually being in the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it would simulate a flyover, if you will. And remember, there was a lot of precise measurements having to be done in order to kind of understand the reflectivity of what was happening to the radar energy as it hit this simulated water. And we essentially had several different rollout rugs, if you will, that would simulate different sea states.
All right, now the horses. So what did you need the horses for?
The horses were part of our security patrol, because you couldn't have vehicles. There were just no roads. Yeah. And
well, motorcycles maybe, but horses can go places motorcycles really can't.
Well, yeah, but those are a lot more costly, and it's, at least then, it was easier to find horseback riders than it was people who would ride a motorcycle. And most of those couldn't get a clearance. So.
I think the biker gangs were not in the population.
So, Chris.
Lions and tigers and bears, oh my.
You're the contracting officer, and there's this vast multi-billion-dollar contract, and they say, oh, what's this line item for $3 million for horses and wranglers? And you say, I can't tell you.
You know, I just finally watched Top Gun Maverick, which is a great movie. It's not a good movie, but it's a great movie, right? It, you know, if you had guessed what it would be, you would get exactly right. You know, amazing effects and, you know, flying and so on and so forth. And absolutely not how things would ever happen in the U.S. military under any circumstances, right? At every level. I'm sort of interested in the veterans' feedback on that. But however, as we discussed, you know, another episode, there was a little play in the system, and it needs to be, right? You know, and having known a lot of people who've done things like that, I'm pretty comfortable with it. I worry, you know, about, you know, abuse and black ops and so on and so forth, that you get inside it and there's people trying to do, you know, good work, and they're decent folks.
So this is a core issue here, right? So John Waver, his middle name Waver, right? That's his dad, right? Okay. And now we know why, right? Because, you know, sorry, I'm not going to explain it to you. There is an underlying level of trust, right? Yes. And really core to this, you know, when you talk about zero trust environments, this is a 100% trust environment. This is called, you know, you just have to trust that he's doing something good and right, because you don't know what it is. And it starts, you know, it's comes out of the Air Force, but it's actually a Navy thing, and it's in the desert for the Navy thing. And they're building, you know, a turntable half the size of a football field, right?
Right. And this is why it's worth, you know, trying to make systems better or worse, you know, to be clear about it, right? You know, that this, you know, it just doesn't just hang a well-run military in this example, right? You know, that doesn't just happen. It's not just some rogue warrior and so forth. You know, there are other people around who understand, and they're trusted by it, and they're trusted by it. And you have a vetting process of years and decades and so forth, and it works. And poorly operated militaries or businesses or anything else, it's all winking and nod and everything else. Right. You know, and we'll take the example of the Russian military, right? You know, that bloody aircraft carrier that's either catching on fire or sinking at any given time, because at every level it's corrupted. You know, would I trust some, you know, these sort of operations in the hands of a structure like that? No, no. In healthy systems, yes, skeptically, keep an eye on it, but, you know.
So recognize this in the context of his career as well, right? So before this, whatever he did in the military, which he won't tell us about, at least not on the air, but, you know, it was whatever they wanted him to do. And then he ends up guarding the X bags, you know, so right, he's right. Got, you know, a gun and a bag of money, you know, and if something happens to the cargo, he's the one they send out, right? And then he goes into the FBI, says, okay, you have 30 days, and, you know, manages to fix that, right? And now he has access to the physical contracts from Hughes, right, that, you know, written on, you know, paper from some hotel bathroom, paper towels. And then, you know, I mean, you just, a career like this of becoming trusted and more trusted and more trusted and more trusted, it's a fantastic, amazing thing. And then you look at that in the context of the FBI having arrested the 20-year-old or 21-year-old, huh. And you look at the stuff that's happening with the Supreme Court justice and all the gifts, and you look at a lot of the other stuff that's happening. And obviously, we can't just have unlimited trust, but if we don't trust people that are worthy of trust, we're really harming ourselves greatly. How do you make those decisions? My goodness.
Well, we have to allow ourselves to trust ourselves. And again, we're cyber geeks. This is a cyber show. We talk about this an awful lot, right? But remember, behind all this are humans. And if you have to, it's a design basic threat that, as we were talking before, design basis threat. If my threat is an average human, then I have to base my design for security based on that. Then it's important that I understand humans, right? And, you know, I've, you know, met someone in the last couple of months, you know, was sailing these boats, who's a mid-70s retired, you know, Grumman engineer, you know, worked on jet, you know, F-14 jet engines, has a drone. Without a lot of great thought, I gave him the keys to my boats, right? Because he's not going to steal anything from him. Get out of here. You know, he's got his stuff together. He's got, you know, he's just, you have to understand, you know, you can build trust, but you need to have transparency and, you know, openness and honesty and all those, you know, Yankee Doodle American Pie things.
You know, there's another issue of consequences, right? Because no offense, but stealing your boat, as harmful as that would be, you know, isn't like, yes, like causing the stealth program, you know, for ships to go away.
Well, right.
And letting the Russians know how much of their information we got and how we got it. Because when you look at what they got, no doubt in that library, the sources and methods, you know.
I place trust rapidly and so forth, and I don't do security on a lot of things, right? You know, I'm sort of notorious for that. And, you know, I am who I am, but at the same time, I'm very self-aware of this, that, you know, that gives the impression that I don't secure things. No. I have things, you know, you secure the things important to this point. You're talking national security and these sort of things. Hold my beer. We're going to lock that down until you're hell and be gone.
Apparently not.
Apparently, a 21-year-old. I gotta say this, you know, I don't hardly any information, just, you know, news headlines, but it seems that he's sort of an innocent idiot. But the whole point is, how did they give that information that to the 21-year-old in the first?
So, let's talk just briefly about that, because I believe I have an understanding of it.
Okay, good.
This, I believe, stems from the fact that we can't get good cyber people to stay in the military,
right,
or in government. We won't pay them competitive amounts. We won't give them the ability to act
right
on things, right? Which is the nature of, you know, what they do when you create this stuff. We sort of crush things into a systematic approach like it was engineering when they're not doing engineering.
Right.
They're doing hacking, right?
Right.
And so when you try to crush hacking, and not bad hacking, we've talked about this plenty.
Hacking, figuring out how things work, like, you know, tinkering. Right.
Tinkering, right. When you try to crush tinkering, then you don't get the advances associated with tinkering. And I think this is what's driving the military. You know, they do need people to be in physical places to do things. And so when you don't have anybody left and you still need to accomplish the mission, you need to put somebody there because somebody has to be there. Otherwise, the printer breaks and you don't get your output, right? So you, the 21-year-old happens to be the only person that, you know, knows enough about printers to be able to turn them back on.
And this is how we get ants.
Well, and look, it's no different than what happens in any other entity, right? The challenge here is understanding the consequences of your actions and addressing them in a reasonable manner through risk management. And what they failed to do was understand the consequences, failed to reasonably address it with risk management, failed to adapt the system to meet the needs. Right. And there's plenty of ways I'm sure it can be adapted. This is nowhere near the first time I've seen this. Right. Before Snowden, I talked to the guy in charge of that organization and explained that they had groupthink and they needed to start, you know, reconsidering these things and so forth. And it happens all the time. And it will continue to happen because the people that end up in charge cannot know what the people that work for them know. The system forces people to be with the game. So you don't have people looking outside the box when you do, or in a bigger box is the way I like to talk about it. And when you do have people that do that and they report it, they usually get fired or pushed aside because they don't want to hear the bad news. They don't want to address it. You see, John, he was in a position where he found the bad news. He explained the bad news and he might well have gotten pushed aside if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, the FBI showed up and said, oh, all this stuff is wrong. And now they said, thank God we have John.
Right.
Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. This is the audio of a video from LinkedIn recorded as based on a true story. Which, of course, means it's not quite true, but it is actually symptomatic of the things that we are seeing on LinkedIn, on the internet these days. I'm not going to include the advice at the end that they provided because the advice wasn't all that good, but I'll have some advice after we listen to it.
My LinkedIn post cost my company a fortune. The crazy thing is, I don't even post that much. It all started with someone leaving a thoughtful comment on my post. This led to us talking, which led to us formally connecting on LinkedIn. He said he was a big recruiter for this huge aerospace company, and even though I wasn't looking for a job, he mentioned that they were hiring a VP of engineering. When I asked what the pay was, he said $500,000. Obviously, $500,000 got me thinking. So he suggested we continue our conversation over WhatsApp, and I gave him my number. We went back and forth for like 2 weeks, and this guy knew what he was talking about. He finally sent me a job offer in PDF, but when I opened it, it was only the cover letter. Like, the next two pages were blank. I reached back out to him, and he said it may have something to do with my PDF viewer because it was a secure file. So he sent me a link to a secure PDF reader, which I downloaded and installed, but it didn't help. I sent him another email, but this time he didn't respond. And from that moment, he literally disappeared. I was really disappointed, but I didn't think too much about it. Weeks later, we had a massive data breach in my company that cost millions of dollars. And during the investigation, the security team traced it back to me. Apparently, the secure PDF reader that I downloaded was malware. Job scams have become a major method of attack because you're expected to talk to a stranger and open documents. But here's my advice.
Okay, there are a few things to note here. The first one is that when somebody sends you a PDF reader or tells you download my PDF reader instead of the one that comes with your operating environment, It's almost certainly a Trojan horse. So just anytime somebody sends you software or says, oh, use my version, it's likely to be the same thing. A lot of people will tell you, well, don't open any PDF file from a stranger or don't run software from a stranger or something about a stranger. But the truth is, everybody's a stranger until you get to know them, and then they're probably still strangers forever. Another important thing to understand is that the fraud stems from the idea that you're interested in a job that pays a whole lot of money from a company. And the thing to do is check it out unless you're really sure. So if you don't, you know it's from the company, if the email address they use isn't from the company, oh, did I mention? They were just talking on LinkedIn. One of the reasons I like to have people send me emails is because the emails come from actual domains, and the domains are typically controlled by the owners of the domain. On LinkedIn, you can't really tell who somebody is. You can't tell what their email address is because this is concealed by LinkedIn in most cases. And of course, you can buy the email addresses of the people on LinkedIn by paying them for some plus-up service, and you can look them up and find their email addresses from a third-party service. Job scams, people looking for jobs. I've been looking for jobs at different times in my life, and I'm sure that people got my information, you know, falsely, you know, under deceptive whatever. So that's how it goes. What you want to make sure of is that you don't provide any information that you wouldn't otherwise be willing to provide, oh, say, published in the New York Times. If you have any questions or you want to bring up other issues or ask about other sorts of cyber crimes, please send us an email, thecybershow.co. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're going to be talking with Tom Johnson about the cyber education world and how he got into it and his involvement, largely surrounding digital forensics and law enforcement and bringing forward cybersecurity into the world in large numbers.
It was unusual, certainly at the time, for people to move that rapidly from job to job, right? This was back in the days when you had a job, you expected you'd stay in it for your lifetime, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was in the area of police and in criminal justice, and so it was so new, and so a few of these places were very interested in trying to start a program up in that area. So, for example, while I was at the Department of Public Administration at the University of Arizona, they were interested in having me start some stuff in this area. And then, of course, the College of Social Professions at the University of Kentucky was very interested in that area as well. And so from there, I went to the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee in 1975. So
Tom, let's just summarize your early career. You couldn't hold a job.
So I was there, and then to show that I could hold a job, after 2 years at Milwaukee, the Washington State University recruited me. So I went there from 1977 to 1982, and basically I was appointed for a second four-year term, but I decided to leave and not finish that second term. And instead, I went to become chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University. And I was there from 1982 to 1994 in Sacramento.
All right. So you were finally able to hold a job, but only in California. Yeah. Is this because you were like a hyper-liberal? I mean, your dissertation was like, you know, how to get police to be able to work with the community, right? So that's the liberal policing, right?
Yeah, right.
And this was at the end of the Vietnam War, when people were coming out of the Vietnam War. And a lot of, you know, soldiers were then, I guess, becoming policemen, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen now, I didn't stay at the University of, I mean, I, I went from California State University to the University of New Haven. And I went there in 1994, and I stayed until 2008.
All right, hang on. So you're rushing ahead here. So at some point along this path of professor, department head, tenure, all these things, you moved from, you know, just sort of standard policing issues into the cyber world, right? So when did that happen?
The cyber world really started when I was at the University of New Haven. Because when I was at the University of New Haven, I went there as professor and dean from 1994 to 2008. And I was the founder and director of the Graduate Forensic Computer Investigation Program. That was one of the first forensic computer programs begun in the United States.
All right. So just for clarity, Tom, by that point in time, by the early 1990s, you know, you were doing all that CSI stuff. So you could, I guess you just took a computer and within a few seconds, you could immediately do all the forensics and tell who the bad guy is and what they did, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So tell us the truth. You know.
Now, what I want to tell you is that, okay, I left California State University in from Sacramento from 1982 to 1994 to go to the University of New Haven. And I got there in 1994. I stayed there to about 2008, where I retired after 14 years service as dean and professor. So I retired. And then in 2008, I moved back to Lexington. And for 3 years, I started the Forensic Data Center, and I was the founding partner and chief operation officer, and we focused on forensic computer crime analysis.
All right, but Tom, you got to stop rushing ahead, okay? We'll get there. We have lots of time, all right? So okay. let's go back to University of New Haven. So you went to the University of New Haven, and up until then, you hadn't done anything in the computer aspect of it, right?
Right. This was really the first time that we started something with computers and computer security and cybersecurity and forensic computer investigation.
So tell me how that started, Tom. I mean, something must have happened that, you know, clicked that said, aha, I'm going to do this instead of that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, when I was at the University of New Haven, okay, I was a professor and dean, but I was also director of the University of New Haven Sandia Livermore campus, which you will...
Wait, but that was way later, Tom. That was way later.
Yeah, that was 2002 to 2000.
Yeah, let's go back in time. Come on. You got to University of New Haven. At some point in time, you went from standard, you know, education about police to something and forensics. You were in forensics. You all of a sudden flipped over into the computer side. What happened to get you into the computer side?
Right. What happened was just simply the knowledge that I had of the potential of computers being applied to the criminal justice area and the marvelous things that it would hold for criminal justice, because up until that point in time, criminal justice really hadn't done diddle in terms of computers and in their operations. In terms of for investigation, I should say. Certainly, they use computers for a variety of things, but this really became quite evident to me that, by gosh, police field could really be upgraded by basically utilizing this phenomenal system of computers in cybersecurity and criminal investigation. So that's 19, 98 was the period that I started that. However, I say 1998, that was the actual official approval by the university for that program. But I had to work for probably a year and a half to get that program approved. So while I began there in 1994, it was actually about 1996 that I started working to get this forensic computer thing approved through the curriculum process. And one of the things that I discovered then, which actually followed me throughout the rest of my academic career, is the incredible resistance that educated people had to approving something in the area of cybersecurity. And typically it was the computer science departments that were the biggest observers and the biggest people to fight it. And this was probably the worst when I got to Webster University, where basically I couldn't believe that educated people there were opposed to it. But I'm getting ahead of it.
So when you can't hold a job, what do?
You know, we're always talking about the arc of time, you know, and so forth. And in Tom's career, it's interesting. Something you said in the first segment, you know, there weren't a lot of those positions, there weren't a lot of those programs, criminal justice, right? And if I read that right, we weren't even really thinking about that until 60 years ago, right? You know, there wasn't a process of thinking through this. You know, law enforcement was law enforcement and justice was the courts, and that was it. So as we try to put together these complex practices for this massively connected world with all these people, you know, they're not just farm labor. You know, we're still that early in even thinking through the process. Why is law and justice applied? Why does it exist, as opposed to just assuming it's something we need to function?
Right. I think that that's probably a proper characterization of the situation at that time.
Fascinating. Right?
Yeah. I think policing, you know, when you talk about it as a science, you know, policing started out, you know, long ago, basically as, I guess they hired people in the early cities of the United States. But they were really sort of like gangs on our side. Right? And, you know, getting it into where it's a scientific endeavor and to where it's well-disciplined. And you see, even today, obviously, it's not as well-disciplined as we would like it. And it's a constant problem. You're taking young people, you know, out of the military or out of, you know, whatever it is that drives them into that desire and putting them through, you know, a couple months of training. And then, you know, a year of probation or something like that, along with a more senior officer. And then they're, you know, that's it. You're the police. You know, you're certainly not going to know as much law as a lawyer. You're going to, you know, be in physical danger all the time. You're going to be under enormous stress. You carry, you know, a lot of heavy stuff around with you everywhere you go. And all sorts of stuff happens, right?
Well, when I'm trying to think of any systems, right? You know, again, Cyber Show, we can talk, you know, the technical stuff all day long. But again, these cyber systems or physical systems or social systems exist because of reasons. So I always like to try to think back to the reasons and, you know, go all the way back. You know, law enforcement started when there was enough people in one group that you couldn't all know each other. And someone had to say, all right, you know, Bob gets to, you know, carry the truncheon. And, and I'm sure it's been done differently, you know, different thoughtful efforts, you know, throughout history. But in American history, yeah, I mean, it started with, you know, the jail is intended to be a hole in the ground that is so horrible that, you know, people will be good trying to stay out of it. And yeah, the enforcement will be, yeah, arguably hired or, you know, deputized thugs, but on our side, right? To what we're doing now, still just beginning to work through. Thinking through why we have these systems. How do they work? What are they trying to achieve? How do they function? Finding flaws in them. And it's, you know, again, it's not judging the past. You know, we've all done what we could to survive and keep things running. But we assume systems are functioning properly because we assume they were founded properly, and maybe they weren't.
Fair enough.
So, scamods. State, County, Municipal Offender Data System. Right? Blues Brothers, 1980, right? Yeah, so you follow that arc, right? You know, from Scamod's and Elwood Blues, you know, that data, and, you know, taking most of 20 years to get into academia.
Tom's view of educated people and his disbelief surrounding, you know, because he's a, you know, a professor and then, you know, head of a department and so on and so forth and doing all this stuff. And he's, you know, inside the belly of the education beast. And, you know, shocked to see there's, you know, resistance to new things in education. But it's to me, it's just fascinating to, you know, listen to. It takes 2 years to get a program approved because the professors are resisting it because they fear it's going to take something away from them. Instead of embracing it and saying, oh, fabulous, you know, why don't we do a joint program between our departments that, you know, we'll get more revenue and we'll get more students and it'll all be good and better, right? But no, jealously guard your fiefdom.
Well, momentum is that our greatest opponent, right? In all things, right? You know, you have a boat, you have something physical that you want to move. What's the worst part about it? It's not moving yet. And getting it started
is so much work.
It's also our great ally.
Right. Yeah, that too. Yes, as is everything, right? And the nuance that Tom, you know, embodies and sort of demonstrates in this, right? You know, you see this, and again, you know, let's look at law enforcement, right? You know, and you take that the next step and say, let's not just talk about how we enforce it better and faster and so forth, but, you know, step all the way back, you know, look at all the components, and that's what Tom has done his whole career, right? So when you're coming in to people who their entire career has been the computer department of this individual university and say, hey, by the way, I've been looking at how all this stuff is connected. You know, the momentum is linear, you know, from their perspective, and you're asking for you know, more complex thought patterns, right?
You know, I guess it's just human nature, but I also sort of think of it as sort of, it's not just, it's the nature of things, it's that the people who are supposed to be the most sophisticated are very often the biggest impediment to progress.
Right. Well, and because they've scoped out the area, they understand it. They're the respected authorities. I mean, you and I get that, you know, in our various fields, and I don't know about you, but I you know, there's a certain special reaction I have when somebody, you know, looks to me, looking to authorities, like, well, this is the way it is, right? And it's like, that's really probably kind of close-ish. At least I think so.
There's a famous quote, right? We have this one on all.net and have had for a long time. Here it is. Yeah, it is by Arthur C. Clarke. When a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he is very probably wrong.
Right, right, exactly, right.
And because nothing is impossible, except, of course, going faster than the speed of light is not currently possible. On the other hand, if that actually transports you back in time, then maybe it is currently possible. We just don't know it yet. There's a theoretical basis for saying in a black hole, time is motion and motion is time. That is, that they work the other way around. So you could presumably go, you know, create a black hole around yourself if you could do it without, you know, destroying yourself. A little bit of a minor engineering challenge there. And then move in space, which would take you back in time, and then remove the black hole and you will be somewhere earlier. But somehow I have my doubts.
Well, we create these, you know, definition fields around ourselves, right? You know, and I just can't help thinking about the nautical analogies as I sit here, you know, watching the boats around me and so forth. Again, we imagine that boats are a certain shape and we imagine that we use them a certain way. So we do, right? That does not mean that's everything the boat can do or you can do with a boat. It's just, you know, it's the mean free path. It's the easiest, you know, slope down the path.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m. Join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day at 11 a.m. join the all.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill limits functionality yet again. John uses cutouts to conceal what's in a huge mining barge. Tom commutes cross-country for millions of miles. More frauds, spies, and lies. Another pitch goes wild. and Maria meets Ada, only on The Cyber Show. See you then.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.